You're listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
Hi, everyone. Once again, the Tennis.com podcast. It's Wednesday, April 2nd. I am Ed McGrogan talking with Steve Tigner about tennis coming up. Tennis has already happened this week, this post-Miami week. We're now into green clay, soon to be red clay, and then in between that, a bunch of different services because it's Davis Cup. It's tennis at its finest, really, there. So, Steve, sort of the big news of this week, which I thought might have been a slow week, and maybe it still is depending on your point of view on it, is Serena going down to going down in her opening match at Charleston 6-4, 6-4 to Yana Sepulova. You did catch some of this, you know. This is so early for Serena in this event. You think of it this way, the event wasn't even televised yet. So I think you caught some of the online feed, though. So really, you know, what did you see in this match? And, you know, just kind of specifically Serena, but of course her opponent as well.
Yeah, I saw from probably the middle of the first set on, Serena started out really poorly, missing a lot, missing pretty much everything. She's done that in her last two matches, had done that in her last two matches in Miami as well against Lina and Maria Sharapova, but she'd come back to win. This time she went down love five to Sepulova, a player that Serena had said she'd hardly even seen before, ranked number 78. Then Serena started to come back, and you thought she can't, you know, got maybe halfway back in the first set, and it looked like, you know, maybe she wouldn't even lose another game. But Sepulova closed the set out, and then Serena started to limp a little bit. She had her left thigh strapped, and then it seemed like she couldn't really. She had trouble deciding how much she wanted to be there, and how much she wanted to win the match, and whether she, you know, wanted to push herself physically. At times she seemed to be into it, and other times not. She said afterwards that she really needed a break, which is not a great sign, since she really had just played one tournament in the last month in Miami, and she's. She says she felt, you know, like she needed to get away, and that it's been a long. She's had a long 2 years, so I don't know if that, what that indicates for her in the future. I mean, as obviously right now she wasn't ready for this tournament. Whether that's some sort of more burnout from a lot of tennis, more tennis than she used to play over the last year or so, last 2 years, you know, we'll see.
I think she said she just felt like hell after the match there. And this is a tournament that she's, you know, the past 2 years she's won, and she's done this Miami-Charleston double, you know, a few times. So it was surprising in that sense, even if I think you can write off a lot of this to just getting back and, you know, just having that big run in Miami. That, and then again, looking for her in the future, I mean, she's not even going to be probably playing again until Madrid, I would guess. You know, it's not like on the men's tour where you're going to see a lot of the top players going to Monte Carlo. So Serena will get, you know, quite a big break after this, I believe, as well. You know, it might be a Stuttgart, I'm forgetting about, but I think she has, you know, some time off after this as well.
Yeah, she usually plays Madrid, which isn't for another month, and then Rome, and then Paris. Last year she won all of those. She, you know, this is the tournament the past 2 years that she's sort of kicked off a pretty strong clay court run. She wasn't into it this time. So we'll see. Hopefully it's not a sign of her, you know, a longer term burnout from her. That's, you know, I guess that's the only question you might have after this match.
Last thing about this, you know, what did you see from Sepulova I don't know if this is your first time watching her any extended amount of time as well, but, you know, what did she do well? What's her game like?
Yeah, I've seen her play a couple times in qualifying. The only thing that I really noticed about her was that she wore her visor slightly askew, a la Donald Young. She also had a pretty good run at Wimbledon a couple years ago, and she, you know, she can play. Credit to her for finishing the match. Serena was still giving it her best in the last game and trying to survive at the end, and Sepulova didn't miss. She, you know, she held it out. She held out. But, you know, she looks good. She's only 20. She's ranked 78th. She hasn't had the results that some of the other 20-year-olds had, but she has a nice forehand and obviously has a solid enough game to stay with Serena.
This tournament is actually turning into a huge exodus for Americans. Today, we've seen Madison Keys lose. Sloane Stephens was the first domino of today to fall, losing, I think, first match on to Ivita Svitolina. She goes down, and specifically, I think the concern has to be raised about Sloane after what we saw from her in Miami, which is practically nothing in her match against Wozniacki. It's a question we bring up time and time again, but this does seem like a particularly low point for Stephens in her, really inability to kind of build consistency on from week to week and tournament to tournament.
Yeah, Sloane, she really bottomed out in Miami. Gave a pretty poor, really poor effort against Wozniacki. This was better. On the one hand, the positive is that this was a better effort, even though she went down early, 1-5, quickly to Svitolina. This was a better effort from her, so that's a positive. The negative is that Svitolina is a rival of hers, similar age. Svitolina is only 19. Sloane had sort of always been ahead of her, stayed ahead of her, and had beaten her earlier in the year, and now Svitolina gets a win over her. So in that sort of battle of the next generation, Sloane, maybe she's losing a step to this player today.
The men, they haven't been around mentioned this week at all because there are no ATP tournaments this week. There are instead the four Davis Cup quarterfinal ties. We have Switzerland going against Kazakhstan. That's at home to Switzerland. I don't think you could set the numbers high enough for Switzerland in that tie. It's going to have Federer, it's going to have Wawrinka, and the opponent is going to be Kazakhstan. So that's, it would be shocking if that even went to Sunday. The remaining ties, the Japan-Czech Republic tie lost a bit of luster today when Nishikori, who, he had to withdraw from Miami, he pulls out of the quarterfinal tie. This is a home tie, too. There was a really good chance for Japan to knock off the Czechs, who are going to be also without Thomas Berdych. So, that's where that sort of injured tie lies. Yeah, the others I think the most interesting one you and I talked about was Italy and Great Britain. It's going to be on red clay. The other tie is Germany at France. France fielding basically an all-star team against Germany. I think the question really just comes down is how much of a chance do you give Great Britain? It's basically their bigger guy, the biggest guy of the tie against sort of a pretty formidable team on Italy.
Yeah, that's the tie to watch. That's going to be, as you say, on red clay. They built a new stadium in Naples. The crowd should be pretty revved up for that one. And as you say, it's the best player of the group, Murray, basically versus the two solid Italian players, Fognini and Seppi. Fognini's had an injury, but he says he should be able to play. Whether he can play three matches or play long matches, two long singles matches, that could be a question. I would still go with Seppi and Fognini overall on clay. That's their favorite surface at home. I think the Italian fans can make a difference. It will be a lot to ask from Murray to win those three matches. I mean, he could do it, but I would bet I would take Italy in this just based on their two players who, two good players against one very good player. It seems to favor the Italians in this.
Yeah, and we still haven't clearly seen Murray as of right now to the level I think we expect that he'll get to at some point, but thus far and on surfaces that he's been great on in the Australian Open, in Miami, we just haven't seen that type of form that probably is going to be demanded of Italy in this tie. Then again, the contrary thing to that is, Britain does of course have that nice away win to start off the tie. I don't know if you can expect the the other players besides Murray to kind of give what they gave against the U.S., you know, a U.S. team that was also missing John Isner at the time. And Italy, of course, I mean, it's probably foolish to entrust yourself in Fabio Fognini in any walk of life. So, yeah, I think for clear reasons that is the best tie of the bunch. And also for no other reason that the winner is almost surely going to get Switzerland. And, you know, depending on where that goes, you know, that really, you kind of think down the road of where this Federer-Wawrinka endgame ultimately goes to. And if, you know, on the chance that they do play Britain, that would be something. Even Italy, of course, too.
Yeah, I think, like you said, it's a tough situation for Murray. He hasn't been at his best. He and his coach, Ivan Lendl, just split up, and he's going to be on his least favorite surface away. It's going to, you know, that'll take a huge effort. He had a great effort against the U.S., but he also needed an upset, James Ward, to pull off an upset over Sam Querrey. They're going to need something like that again, and it seems even less likely against the Italians.
The two players you're not going to be hearing from this weekend, Davis Cup, Rafael Nadal, Novak Djokovic, the other two of the big four. They just turned 40, as you put it on the site today. You wrote a piece about kind of where their rivalry stands after 40 matches. You know, what was kind of the thought behind this piece, first of all, for people who haven't read it yet?
Well, it was just, you know, it was at a point right now, obviously 40 matches is a lot. It's a rivalry that, and it's still going. You know, they're still 20. They're only 27 and 26 years old, and they've already played 40 times. It also seemed like a good time to assess that they're 22. Rafa's up 22-18 in the head-to-head, so it's close, and it's been getting a little closer over the last few years. Slowly, Djokovic has been closing that, and also, I feel like it's. The rivalry right now has swung around in the last 6 months pretty full circle and a lot more quickly than you might have thought. In September, Nadal beat Djokovic for the third straight time to win the U.S. Open and take over number one from him. It seemed, you know, at that stage, like that Rafa may have, you know, solved some of his problems against Djokovic on hard courts. He had also won six of the last seven at that point. Now, but really what it did, it sort of freed up Djokovic to make his own kind of counterattack, and he's won the last three matches pretty easily, which leaves them coming into probably the most important part of the year, the clay season, seeming to me to be pretty even. Djokovic maybe a little ahead in their one-on-one, but Nadal still number one in the rankings and still obviously the best player on clay. So it seems like we're at a point where, you know, it'll be interesting to see which way it goes from here.
Yeah, well, you know, what I wanted to ask really about the clay portion here is, you know, for the past couple of years, you know, these two have met up at a lot of the big French Open warm-up tournaments. You know, there is obviously, I think, this question that is kind of begging to be answered again of whether Djokovic has it in him to take down Nadal at the French Open after how close he got last year and now with this more recent surge here. I'm wondering if you would like to... I'm wondering if you ever think that there is too much of a good thing, perhaps, with these two. You know, 40 matches is such a huge number in terms of tennis head-to-heads. You know, in your piece, you point out some historic rivalries that really didn't even come close to that number. But I never got the sense that you felt that way about Nadal and Djokovic. I mean, do you want to see these two meet up at, for example, Monte Carlo, Rome, Madrid, and the French Open, or is it just kind of maybe savor when they do?
Well, I mean, yeah, you could say that maybe they play too many times, but a couple times in the past when Nadal and Federer met up, they met up in Monte Carlo, then they met in Rome, then they met in Paris, and then Djokovic and Nadal have met up at various times on their way to the French Open. I got the opposite feeling that I wasn't sick of it. I felt like it really built up over the course of that 2 months, the sort of tension between, you know, and what was going to happen in Paris, and it's played out in a pretty exciting in some pretty exciting matches at the French Open. So no, I wouldn't say. I mean, maybe overall, like, they play a lot, and I don't think you need to see them. I don't need to see them play every tournament, every final. But in this part of the year, I feel like this is a major part of the year for, especially for Djokovic, to try to win the French Open, the only Grand Slam he hasn't won. But seeing them play each week or three times leading into the French Open wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. I think it would add something to the season and make people look forward to the French Open more.
Very good. Like I said, Steve's piece on Rafa Nadal turning 40. Check that out on tennis.com. Up right now, Wednesday. You'll find it there, among other things, from our team here. So, for Steve Tigner, I'm Ed McGrogan. Tune in next time for the tennis.com podcast.
You've been enjoying tennis.com's weekly podcast. Thanks for listening. For all the latest news and events, head over to tennis.com.